Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. It's not that common to include the salary range in a job posting. So how do you make sure you're getting paid a fair amount or making the right decisions for your career? Allison Venditti is a career coach and founder of Mums at Work, and she's going to be here to talk about the importance of pay transparency. Then you may have come across some trending personal finance videos if you're into TikTok. It's called FinTok or Financial TikTok. Canadians Jessica Rowett and Colleen Cormos started an account called Two Girls Investing, and they're both going to be here to talk about what they've been doing on TikTok and that relevance of that platform for many younger folks as they learn about money. And many Canadians invest in real estate. They want to rent out their property to make a profit. Maybe it's, you know, a basement. Maybe it's another home entirely. Not the easiest thing to do. If you're thinking of it, though, you want to make sure that you're going to do it right. Megan Chomut is a certified financial planner. She is the CEO of Port Rouge, and she's going to talk about tips for getting started and some of the mistakes to avoid. And also on the topic of rental properties, how to finance the purchase of one. I'll speak with Paul Leonard, CEO of Wealth One Bank of Canada, a new-ish, like last 6 years, 7 years or so, a new-ish bank with a specialty in this area. Plus, filing taxes when you have a side hustle or are self-employed. It's a little bit different than if you're just working for a company and getting a T4 at the end of the year. Chartered professional accountant Dean Paley is here to take us through the process. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. The two most common strategies to build wealth are investing in the stock market and investing in real estate. The former often includes the services of a financial planner, like a lot. It includes the services of a financial planner, but the latter does not for a bunch of reasons. So it really piqued my interest when I saw the profile of our next guest. Megan Chomut is a certified financial planner. That's a designation you know. She is also the CEO and lead advisor at Port Rouge. It is a company that offers financial planning and advice for real estate investors. And she joins me now from Thunder Bay, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Port Rouge, Red Door in French. I get that. Why this for your firm?
So when I first started my career in finance, I actually moved overseas. I'm originally from Ontario, but I moved overseas to Scotland and I worked at the head office branch of the Royal Bank of Scotland. And one of the really amazing traditions that I noticed over there was that when you pay off your mortgage, you have like a celebration and you paint your door red. And I just loved that concept because I feel like money is something that we're not always super comfortable talking about, even like our struggles as well as our accomplishments. And so this was just like a way to signify not only that they did this huge milestone accomplishment, but also they communicated it to their community, just like adding inspiration to others, saying like, I did this big thing and I want to celebrate. And if I can do it, you can do it too. And
I love it.
So did I. I just loved it so much that I knew that I needed to incorporate that in some sort of messaging in my business, in the way that I work with clients. And that's how it all started.
What had you decide to get into rental properties, to focus on rental properties in the first place?
Yeah, really good question as well. I might be dating myself here a little bit, but I grew up watching a show called Trading Spaces, where neighbors, friends, relatives would switch a room in their house and they would each redecorate it secretly.
Yes.
Do you remember this? And this was me. So I'm this, you know, teenager, young person. I'm like, I just want to rearrange your bedroom. I just want, like, let me help you do something cool in this space. And when I became an adult, it was like, kind of just started evolving. And I was like, okay, I need to be able to incorporate this like creative side as well as my money stuff. And it just kind of came really naturally of in terms of a progression, because I was working a job that didn't have a pension. I have a background in finance. I'm a CFP. I know all about planning, and I couldn't figure out how to get the numbers to work for me to be able to retire at a lifestyle that I was goal oriented towards, as well as a timeline that I was kind of thinking about. So once I incorporated like a rental space into that equation, it just really accelerated things for me.
You, as you mentioned, are a CFP. The typical CFP does a financial plan based on stock market investments. Like that's kind of the starting point. You're going to save this amount of month. It's going to go into, maybe it's a mutual fund, maybe it's an index fund. Here's how you're going to do that. Your focus is different. What do you do when you work with clients? Because the bulk of their wealth is not going to be in the stock market.
So when people come to me, they either have a goal to get started and they just don't know where to start, or they have their first rental property. And I call them my accidental rental property owners, meaning like they bought a house for their child while they went away for school, or they were two single people who now have decided to move in together, but they kept both houses kind of thing. And they just need some guidance in terms of, was this a smart decision? It feels like a smart decision, but like, was it? And so we create their financial plan to incorporate both elements, both the financial markets, as well as that piece of real estate, because they really do need to work together to be able to accomplish their goals.
There are fee-only financial planners out there. There aren't a million of them, but it is a category, less common, but there are people who do it. For, $2,000 to $5,000, you get a full financial plan. How do you work? What's the typical engagement for you?
Yeah. So I'm fee only as well. And the engagement with me can be two different options. I can do a financial plan for you and provide it to you, next right steps. This is where your guardrails are. This is where you should be in 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, and so forth, so that you can kind of gauge your metrics for success. The other way that I work with clients is we create that same roadmap, but we worked together implementing the plan so that when things come up, when questions arise, they're able to connect with me. I'm a sounding board. We tweak the plan and then we continue accordingly.
One of the advantages of a stock market oriented retirement plan is it's relatively simple. You need to sort out your cash flow as a family. You carve off what you're going to save. You put it in the markets and on you go. Here, your clients need to work the cash flow in two realms. The family P&L, is there enough for groceries? And then the P&L on the rental property. How much involvement do you have on that, such that you're confident the owner of the rental property has enough squirreled away for the furnace repair and the 3 months in which the rental property is vacant because someone fled town, that kind of stuff?
I mean, both pieces of those puzzles are essential. And so it's really important to first identify whether or not that particular investment property was a smart decision. Does it cash flow? What is the leverage on it? If there were to be an issue, can your personal situation subsidize that investment property? And is that something you're willing to do? And so both of those, they're not mutually exclusive. We need to deal with them both at the same time.
One of the things that I like about your experience is you're not in a big city with 14,000 condo towers, because it would be a different if you were in Calgary, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, that has a very, very urban dynamic. Thunder Bay has a very different dynamic. How do you layer in the market dynamics in the location that the client is investing in?
So that is one of the things where I need to lean on other professionals who are in those areas so that I can be able to provide insight. But one of the, if they do have a property there or they are living there or whatever their situation is, but one of the things that I always say to people when they're first evaluating their property or just getting started in real estate investing is, when you first are looking at properties, it's kind of like you need to identify the market that you're in as well as the market where there are smart investments. you can go grocery shopping at Canadian Tire, but you will find some food, but not maybe the groceries you really need.
I've never seen a head of lettuce at a Canadian Tire. You're right. No. But boy, s'mores. Yes.
Yes. Candy, chips, mm-hmm. you know, all those things. So the market that you might live in might be a great rental market or where you should be renting, but it's not going to be a profitable investment property area. So it's really important to distinct those two things. Mm.
Can you give us some examples of red flags that you see when you're talking to people that would indicate to you that this is not a fit for the person you're, you know, maybe a client, maybe a prospective client, that real estate or rental properties is just not a good fit for you. And you should go the old traditional way of putting your pennies into the stock market because this isn't going to work well for you.
So the first thing that I would say there is a rental property is not going to fix your financial situation. I promise you, if you are feeling overwhelmed or already feeling stress about money, the solution isn't to add a rental property to the mix, even if it is a winner, even if it's a home run. I use the analogy that adding a rental property to an already shaky framework in terms of finances is like two people who are having, you know, relationship turmoil, thinking the solution is to have a baby.
That is a great example. Made my blood run cold just there.
Yes. And that is, I think there's a lot of rhetoric in the media, on podcasts, on social media that investing in real estate is going to solve all your problems and provide financial freedom and blah, 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 blah. Mm. And I promise you that if you ask that person spouting that misinformation for receipts, they will not be able to provide it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the dose of cold water, the bucket of cold water that people mm-hmm. need to have. And I really appreciate that we finished with that. Megan, thank you so much.
Yes, absolutely. Anytime.
Megan Chomut is a certified financial planner. She is CEO and lead advisor at Port Rouge. And the focus of our conversation is about, you know, thinking about the financial plan when you want to include real estate or rental properties into the mix.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
TikTok is creating a whole new set of online influencers, like Instagram before it and YouTube before that. In the financial space, it's called FinTok. And I know that this entire lead up just made me sound like I'm 117 years old, that I would need to explain what these things are, but it is relevant background for our next guest. Jessica Rowett and Colleen Cormos started their own TikTok account called Two Girls Investing. The objective is to help educate other people about money, and they've got like 45,000 followers, something like that. They're joining us from Whitehorse, Yukon, to talk about what they have learned so far through FinTok. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Jess, first to you, why did you decide to start making personal finance videos on TikTok?
Well, originally it came from my, you know, my journey of getting financial education and how frustrated I was that there wasn't much information out there. And the information that was out there was in really complicated terminology. So I decided that, you know, I wanted to take all the stuff that I learned and put it out there. And I learned about TikTok. And the thing with TikTok is it doesn't just put the videos out to your followers. It pushes it out to a large group of people who may not even follow you. So the exposure is so much greater than any other social media platforms right now. So that's kind of why we took it to TikTok right off the bat.
And so, Colleen, who, now that you've got a sense for your audience, who are they? It's that's more than just the population of Whitehorse.
Yeah, we always we've joked about it as we've grown bigger than the size of Whitehorse, but it's pretty exciting. So the majority of our followers are Canadian, which makes sense to us because we talk in Canadian terminology and language. So we're simplifying it for Canadians, and the majority is women. So we're providing a lot of advice and education, but there's a big gap for women in getting that education and getting it from other women. So the majority is, women in Canada.
Jess, what is the biggest video you've done? What's got the most, I don't know what you call them, views? What do you call it in Atlanta? The views? Okay, good. Yeah, what's the one that's got the, that's resonated the most with your audience?
The one that's had the most had 1.6 million views, and it happened pretty like right early when we started. So that kind of took us off. And that one is just basically doing a step-by-step, how do you get started investing, opening a TFSA, what are the options for investing, and how can you do it in a step-by-step process? And I think that just resonated with people because they haven't had the whole picture of like, okay, how do I do this from start to finish?
Colleen, tell us about your creative approach here. So one of the ones that I saw, you're in the car. There is lots of graphics that are red and white. It definitely feels Canadian. You're both super approachable. This is not a four-camera shoot with 12 lighting technicians and a drone. How do you approach it?
Yeah, so we've done all of the videos from our phone. Neither of us knew a lot about creating videos. I had a little bit of experience on other platforms, but TikTok was very new to us. It's been a huge learning curve. And we do it from our phones. We've got a few kind of apps that we're using that help us out, but we're really learning as we go. And we're slowly getting a little bit more efficient with it.
Jess, I love that you're... The integrity of your perspective is accurate from my standpoint. I'm a journalist by background. I've been covering this stuff for a very, very long time. And one of my frustrations with the social media world is that sometimes people get it wrong. How do you navigate that? How do you sort of like, I don't know, put the filter on that ensures that what you're delivering is accurate and helpful?
Yeah, that's a really good question because there's a lot of misinformation out there and we don't want to be the ones putting that out there. So if we're doing a video about something, I just always make sure that it's something that we know really well and that we do a little bit of extra research before we do the video just to make sure it's accurate because we don't want to be putting wrong information out there. So we just make sure that it's stuff that we actually know. We're never going to put anything out there that we haven't done ourselves or haven't done extensive research on. And it's stuff that we've checked across other platforms and other sources to make sure that it's accurate.
Colleen, what are the limitations? So YouTube, you could put on, you know, like an hour long video. Maybe people wouldn't watch it, but you could post it there. TikTok is not the place for anything long form. What are some of the limitations?
I mean, they've just come out with the ability to have longer videos, but we find with our finance and budgeting and investing that people like the smaller doses of education. And that's one of the reasons why we like using TikTok is that we can get those smaller messages across and more of them so that people can retain the information. So our long-term plans are looking at other platforms to use, but that's one of the positives that we like about TikTok is that it's that shorter messaging.
Our listeners can't see this, but both of you are in your cars on your break, on your lunch break from your day jobs. Jess, how does this fit with what you do professionally, with what pays your rent?
Yeah, so we both work full-time outside of doing Two Girls Investing. So our time is limited in what we can do. So we're doing it outside of work, evenings, sometimes breaks at work and weekends. So we've really had limited time to do it, but we've been fitting it in pretty good, I think.
Colleen, where is Two Girls Investing in 5 years? If like the universe just sprinkles its good karma on your platform, maybe it's TikTok, maybe it's somewhere else, what do you see?
Yeah, that's a very big question. I definitely see us expanding into other platforms, other avenues, continuing to provide the education. And we do have big goals and big dreams with Two Girls Investing and just making sure that we're giving Canadians and specifically Canadian women the education and tools to be able to take control of their finances. So that's really what motivates us. And we just want to continue to share that. And the success messages we get are overwhelming. Mm. So the more that we can do that, the more that we would like to. So hopefully in the future, we're not doing it from our car anymore. Yeah.
Jess, one last question before we go. Before we go, there are so many Canadians and Canadian women who would love to be talking about investing, who are engaged by your personalities and your content, and yet they're not there yet. They've got, they're living outside of their means. They have a massive amount of credit card debt, like all those other real challenges. Where do you send them if your focus on investing, it's just too early? They're just not quite ready.
That's a really, really good point, because we don't want people investing who have massive credit card debt or don't have an emergency fund built up. So we're trying to focus that on that on our page too, is, you know, financial literacy before you're investing to get you to a place where you're ready to invest. So we're hoping to get more of that actually on our page. We covered it a little bit, but we want to get it a little bit more. But if people aren't at the place to invest, you know, going online and getting some financial books is a good place to start. There's lots of really good books out there that cover how to get to that spot. But we do have a few videos too saying, you know, number one, pay off high interest credit card debt. Number two, build up an emergency fund to have money for short term goals. And then if you have some money ready that you can put to the long term, then you're ready to start investing.
Pauline, last question for you. How do you manage your own TikTok behavior? I have a 12-year-old, and left unsupervised, they would be on that platform for 12 hours straight. I am sure the For You feature would take them into the night. Do you have an alarm on your phone to say, enough, go make dinner?
You know what? I don't. And I do sometimes fall into that kind of rabbit hole where I'm on it for 15, 20 minutes to get maybe some ideas or some audio content. And I end up, you know, in it, on it a little bit later at night than I would like to, but I'm pretty, I watch how I use my time because it's so limited with all of the, areas that we're working on right now. So I really only go on it to watch videos maybe once a week. And then knowing that if I'm on it, it'll sometimes last a bit longer. So yeah, I totally understand that rabbit hole thing that we can all go down on social media. And TikTok's really good for it because they're quick, short videos that keep you there.
It's never ending.
Yeah.
Two Girls Investing, that is the name, handle, I don't know what you call it, descriptor of their TikTok account. And they joined us to talk about their experience in the world of FinTalk. Coming up next on Moolala, the importance of pay transparency. Career coach and the founder of Mums at Work, Allison Venditti, will be our guest. And later, I'll speak to Paul Leonard, CEO of Wealth One Bank of Canada, about what it takes to finance a rental property. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, our newsletter is a great way to do that. It's got stuff from this show on SiriusXM, from CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. To sign up for that, you go to moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. We know there is a pay gap between genders. The data has illustrated this problem for years and years and years. And it exists for many underrepresented groups in our cultural mosaic in Canada too. One of the strategies to address it is to increase the level of pay transparency in the job market. Why will that help? How could it work? When will it happen? Allison Venditti is a career coach and the founder of Mums at Work, which is an organization that helps women find jobs they love. She is here with her context on that. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
You argue that pay transparency is one way to fix, or at least affect the wage gap? Why?
So for Canadian listeners, this is something that is normalized in unionized employers and has been for decades. So any union job you apply to, you know exactly what you're going to make, exactly what everybody else makes, exactly what's on the table. When I switched from working in unions to corporate and nobody talked about money, I was shocked. But it's one of the fastest ways to close that pay gap. Because then everybody knows what everybody else is making, and it becomes unacceptable for some people to be making 50% more than someone else in the same job.
And there's a nuance here in that with the same job, it's indefensible. You can't even fathom it. But one of the things that happens is that you start to see, wait a sec, marketing gets paid a whole heck of a lot more than the call. And the call center people may skew towards a different demographic group. How do employers navigate that kind of dynamic? Given that those the pay range for marketing is driven by the market for marketing jobs versus anything else that they might have a political view about.
So pay transparency doesn't address valuation of jobs. It's a pretty simple concept in the fact that if you're hiring someone, you should tell them what you're going to pay them, as opposed to pay equity, which is like the valuation of different types of roles. And then, you know, we can get into that thing where society devalues female dominated industries, but you know, I digress. That's not really what pay transparency is meant to fix. It's meant to open up the conversation as to why these five people who all have very similar jobs in marketing have a span of $50,000 because one person is a man and one person's a woman. That's what it's meant to sort of drive out. It's not an all-encompassing solution.
What is the application of the pay transparency thinking that an individual could advocate for? And I'm asking that even though I know that most of this is going to be, the progress is going to be made by senior leaders who say, wait a sec, hold on, we just need to do this across the board. That's not necessarily the audience to this show, but individuals are who work in organizations who are like, I do wonder how much I get paid or those kinds of things. What can they do?
And so I'm going to argue that that is not actually how the change is going to be made. Change is actually going to be made on the ground by people starting to talk about this. So if you're applying for a job and they say, you know, what's your salary range? You can beat them to the punch and be like, before we go down this path, can you please let me know what the salary range is? Because as an HR person, I will tell you 100%, I have never, ever hired for a role that I did not know what I was going to pay that person ever in my life. And I was a headhunter for years. So that information is already there. It's up to individuals to A, start asking, B, start talking about it with your friends. Hey, Allison, what do you make? And I know how that uncomfortable, like that is so uncomfortable to ask someone that. So instead you can have this conversation with your coworker. Hey, do you make more than $100,000 or less than $100,000? It's called the over-under game. So pay transparency absolutely will be the revolution pushed by individuals that then forces the hands of companies to answer their questions. If every person who applies for a job asks how much it's paying, soon it becomes a norm. So I argue that it's going to push this way as opposed to coming from on high.
One of the things our listeners are used to me saying is any of these uncomfortable topics that you bring up, just blame it on me. So just say, I was listening to Bruce and Allison and they said we should be talking about this. And here's how that goes. Now that it's uncomfortable sometimes, you get the information. What do you do if you realize that you're like 20 grand offside compared to the person sitting across from you at Starbucks?
So as an HR person, we have that conversation. So I've had people come and say to me, I need to sit down. It's been brought to my attention that I am paid this amount of money less than some of my coworkers. How are we going to rectify that?
And what did you say? And what did you say as an HR person?
I said, in my head, I'm like, yeah, you know, obviously that's a problem, but I will be very clear that we fix that very quickly or else we lose people very quickly. And honestly, for people who find out that they're being paid $20,000, $30,000 less than a coworker, they're already out the door. So pay transparency actually helps with retention. That is not a conversation that should be happening at work. And one of our top salespeople should not be finding out that they're paid that much less than someone else. It shouldn't happen.
there is a gender dynamic here, not just in the numbers, but in the temperament, the level of confidence that some women feel versus some men. And I use that that context carefully because I don't want to generalize that every woman is afraid to ask for a raise and every man is super confident. But the data shows that women are less likely to storm into the boss's office than a guy and say, hey, raise time because. So what advice would you offer to women in engaging this in this conversation, even if it might make their blood run cold?
That's the tricky part in that, like, we can't force people who were raised not to talk about money to suddenly be like, by the way, like, you're gonna have to change your mind and do this. It takes more than that. So that's when you flip the coin and say, this is why it's so important to then, if you're dealing with that issue at work, to advocate for legislation. So that's what work is doing very actively. We have pay transparency legislation now in PEI. BC has struck a roundtable. Ontario already has legislation. It should not be put on women to have these difficult conversations. Mm. We can do more as a society. This is a very simple way to normalize this. So that's what I would say. Go the other way.
When you're asked the question, when an employer is asked the question, quite often you will hear that's because. So the wage gap is because, for our listeners, we're on Zoom. I can see Allison's face. She beamed from ear to ear because this is clearly a passionate, now she's cackling. This is clearly a thing. So one of the that's becauses would be, well, that's because they've been here for 25 years. So while you're doing the exact same job, you've been here for two. How do you address some of the that's becauses?
I would say, great. I'd love to see your pay equity data on that.
Okay. And for employers of a certain size, should that be readily accessible?
For every employer, so if they haven't done it, that's their indication that they need to start.
Right.
So
now pay equity applies to different sizes of organizations, doesn't it? Like the standard is lower if you've got five people in the office.
Right. So I would say that, like, other than legislatively, if you're not doing pay equity reviews, which most employers are, then you have a problem. So it doesn't need to be mandated for employers to review it. Most big employers are not mandated by pay equity legislation, except for federal. So, but that's a very quick trip to, like, putting HR down the road running.
Mm. Now, there will be those men and women who will be concerned about being painted with the troublemaker brush for asking that question. Based on your personality, based on my personality, that has never been a concern for me. I am quite happy to stir the pot. And I wouldn't be surprised if you have been quite happy to stir the pot over the course of your career. There are many people who are simply not comfortable doing that. What options do they have?
And also, I'll preface, for some people, it's not safe.
Yeah.
Like, if you're in a, if you need this job, you can't rock the boat. Like, that is not an option for you. That is why advocacy groups are so important. I will say, for some people, it is absolutely not safe. I'm not going to justify and say that everybody should be running out and doing this. If your job is at risk, you work for a smaller employer who would be like, get out. No, it's not a good move. So for those people, I say that, like, this is the absolute importance to have other people advocating for this, because the change is not going to be made for those people. It is entirely unsafe for those people to have this conversation.
We are in a period in which the employment prospects for Canadians is so incredibly good in aggregate, right? Our unemployment rate is at historic lows. How does this change as things become more uncertain and as inevitably, maybe it's a year, maybe it's a month, maybe it's 5 years, that unemployment rate ticks up?
Pay transparency for me and for most people falls under the diversity, equity, and inclusion. So we can't talk about equity at work if we're not talking about money. Mm. So that's where it sits for me. It doesn't sit in retention. It doesn't sit for attraction. It sits in equity. So if anybody in your organization is having real hard talks about diversity, equity, inclusion, and they're not talking about money in terms of equity, it doesn't mean anything.
Right. They're talking about pride lunches and parades and safe space stickers on the door.
So that's where you bring it up to be like, I understand we have a DEI initiative. How does pay factor into this?
That's great. Allison, I really appreciate you making the time today. You are passionate, you are insightful, and you're clear on what we need to do and how we can do it better.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Allison Venditti is a career coach. She is the founder of Moms at Work. And she joined me to talk about why pay transparency is so critical, not just to fix the wage gap, but also for our equity, diversity, and inclusion initiatives.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, financing your rental properties. I'll speak with Paul Leonard about what makes Wealth One Bank of Canada kind of unique. But first, how to file your taxes if you're self-employed. Chartered professional accountant Dean Paley will be here. If you've got a personal finance question or a comment about the show, story idea, a complaint, send all of your thoughts, any of your thoughts, good, bad, indifferent, to ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
If you have a job, filing your taxes is pretty easy. A few forms, an online process, clickety-click, and you're done. But if you're recently self-employed or you recently started a side hustle, you may be learning that filing taxes takes a little bit more work and will in the future. Dean Paley is a chartered professional accountant in Burlington, Ontario, and he's here now to talk about some of the things you should know if you're going to have some self-employed income or maybe entirely self-employed income on your taxes. Hello, Dean.
Hello, Bruce.
What are some of the big things that you would highlight as being different about the process for people filing taxes when they have self-employed income, either entirely, like that's what they do, or mm-hmm. it's a side hustle that augments a jobby job?
Well, when you have a job, as you said, you get your tax slip and you fill out your tax return and everything's good to go. When you're self-employed, you've got income to track. So you have to be able to keep records of who's paying you and for what work is being done. And then you have expenses that you may incur to earn that income. Those expenses could be automobile expenses. They could be office supplies. They could be meals for meetings, any range of those items.
Years ago, I left a job and I started freelancing. No tax was withdrawn at source and I spent every penny I made to pay the rent. This was a big problem when tax time arrived. What advice do you have for people so that they don't find themselves in this situation?
That's a great question. One of the things that they could do is to estimate what they are going to earn from their sales or from their self-employment income after expenses, if they can factor that in, and then make an estimate of the taxes. There's lots of websites out there that you can do a quick calculation to figure out what your tax liability would be, and then you can put that money off to the side. If you don't know what your expenses are going to be, a quick top line thing, particularly if you're in the gig economy, is to maybe just use your sales and estimate what your income or estimate what your taxes would be for a given period.
You have been doing this for a long time. Uber is a relatively new phenomenon, and really the gig economy in this way is new-ish. What have you learned that is really different in the last, call it 5 years, when this really became a part of the zeitgeist?
Well, we have seen a lot of new self-employed people come in to seek for our assistance with their taxes. One of the things that somebody perhaps might not be aware of is they might have to register for HST mm-hmm. or GST. So, for example, they're required to, and Uber and Lyft and the ride-sharing services are pretty good about making sure that the drivers do register and collect the HST, or they collect it for them. But other ones, like if you're selling through Amazon, you may have to collect HST depending on the situation, and some other platforms as well. You may be registering even if you're below the $30,000 registration requirement.
And why even if? So I have that $30,000 figure in my mind. Why would you need to collect it if you were below that threshold?
Well, in the GST world, if you're a taxi, then you're required to register regardless of the limit. Right. So there are certain circumstances where you may be just simply required. The taxi's the big one, but you do have to keep your eye on it, and it is something definitely you'd want to look into to make sure you not get offside. It can get ugly if...
Yeah. What are some simple rules you would apply on what are deductible expenses? Because I'm sure you've seen some pretty outrageous examples of things that the CRA will simply not pass.
Things that typically would come up from the CRA's perspective would be excessive meals and entertainment expenses, automobile expenses are another area that tend to be looked at. Generally speaking, when you're taking looking for expenses, the general rules: if you incurred the expense to generate the income, you can deduct it. If it was purely personal, then you can't deduct it. Things that I've seen, you know, you can't deduct your groceries, but you can deduct a portion of your home if you work there.
What are some of the best ways for people to track the expenses, track the income? There are a million and one apps out there. There's all sorts of tax filing software and bookkeeping software. What would you recommend people look for or look at when it comes to that part of it?
I would look for something that's simple and easy for them to use. Mm-hmm. Something that would track sales taxes if they need to, and something that makes it convenient to connect their payment systems, such as their bank account or a credit card, to track those expenses.
How do you think about taxes if your business doesn't make a profit? So there are some people who have self-employed income, but it's a passion project. They love to do it. They're doing magic at birthday parties. It's earned income. They know they need, and they invoice for it. They know they need to be on side of the CRA, but it's not a lot of money, or it's no money at all.
If it's there's a difference between a hobby and an adventure in the nature of trade, which we refer to as a business. So if you're pursuing profit to make money, then definitely it's a business, and there would be more of a formal structure. If it's just something you're doing for fun, and really you're just getting your costs reimbursed, it may just simply be a hobby, and it might not necessarily be a reportable item, although if you're ever uncertain, you're always best to report and claim the expenses against it rather than not.
What if it was something that really is a business? It's just going to take a while for it to become profitable, and you have to incur expenses to buy tools such that you can practice your trade or whatever. I'm making up a scenario here.
Yep.
How does the tax framework work in that circumstance?
If a business generates a loss in a particular year, that loss can be deducted against any other income for that year. If there's still a loss left over, it could be carried back 3 years, or it could be carried forward 10.
Many people listening to this will be like, okay, so I've got this side hustle, or I'm self-employed. At what point should I incorporate, and should I go provincial or federal? What would be your wisdom on those two questions?
On the incorporation, there's a couple of factors that you'd want to consider from a pure taxation point of view. If you have another job and you don't necessarily need the income from the side business and you want to save it, then incorporation may be a good venture for you. You could benefit from a low tax rate. In Ontario, that's about 12.2% right now, which is a deferral. If you have a considerable amount of income and you're trying to survive off of the profit, and you are finding that you have accumulated savings, then that might be a point to which you might want to consider incorporation. On a peer's numbers basis, around $40,000 of profit is somewhat of a break-even point between combined personal and corporate taxes and earning through self-employment as a sole proprietor.
Just before we go, I want to ask the question about family members, because if you're self-employed, you may have a spouse doing a part of that work. You may want to pay that spouse an hourly wage or some sort of amount to compensate them for that work. What are some watchouts on involving family on the self-employed side?
When you have family members, you want to make sure that you're paying them a wage that you would pay an independent third party. You have to be careful not to pay more than what you would pay somebody else to do the same work. You wouldn't want to pay your spouse $500 an hour to do administrative work that you would pay somebody else $30 an hour to do. That would be the other thing you'd want to do is make sure that you track the time, what was done.
Right. So there's a fair amount of rigor on this front. You can't just make it up.
Yeah, correct. You cannot make it up.
Interesting. Dean, thank you for your time today.
No problem. It's nice to meet you.
Dean Paley is a chartered professional accountant in Burlington, Ontario, and he was here to talk about some of the subtleties on prepping to file your taxes if you are self-employed or if you've got a side hustle going, which many, many, many Canadians now do. Stay with us. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about financing rental properties. Paul Leonard is the CEO of Wealth One Bank of Canada, and he's going to give us some of the tips. For more Moolah La, you can head over to moolahla.ca. At that site, you can listen to episodes by topic. You can listen by guest name. You can listen to the whole episode. You can also go to any of the podcasting platforms and get prior episodes. Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, Apple Music, wherever it is. And while you're there, you could write a review or you could subscribe so the next episode just comes to your device automatically. Moolah La is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you're in pretty good financial shape, getting a mortgage on your principal residence is pretty straightforward. You gather your info, you call a lender or a mortgage broker, they check your credit score, they talk to you about rates, they talk to you about features, and you're done. It is not so simple, though, if what you're trying to do is get a mortgage on a rental property. Paul Leonard is the CEO of Wealth One Bank of Canada, and he joins us now to talk about the process, if that is indeed your goal. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
I'm great. There is so much talk about real estate in this country. There are so many people who see this as being a part of their financial plan. They either love it or they believe that that's the way to wealth for them. What is different when it comes to financing rental properties than if it's the house you're going to sleep in every night?
Typically, rental properties are where an individual is already sleeping in their own home, have a mortgage on that, and they've decided to invest their funds in another property. And in doing so, the income that's associated with that property is a function of the tenant that you have involved. It's a function of the costs related to maintaining the property. And most importantly, the cost of obtaining a mortgage on that particular property and the interest rate that you can get and to earn a profit on your real estate.
How do you make the call on who gets the thumbs up on a mortgage for a rental property and who does not?
Typically, we still look at the credit experience of the borrower, the investor, and the piece of real estate. One of the most important components of any underwriting, whether it's on your own property or on a rental property, is your demonstrated willingness and ability to pay your debts. and satisfy your debts. And so we would evaluate the credit score. We then, if you pass muster related to that, then we begin to look at the underlying economics of the property that you're looking to get financed.
I can imagine your rigor on that is higher than it would be on a principal residence, in that there's fewer variables. If you live in the house, you're not worried about someone not paying the rent for a couple of months and how you're going to cover that, because that's not the way that works. How detailed a process is that for you to work with the applicant to say, I'm not sure you're going to be able to get that level of rent, or you didn't factor in enough money to account for a furnace repair?
Yeah. So really, you kind of began to ask the same questions that we begin to ask, which is really starting to dig down into what are your expectations of the property? Is there a tenant in the property? Are they paying rent? What's the rental rate? And really it begins a longer process of discovery on the property. So when you have you're living in your home, your lender is going to ask you about, what's your T4? And that's pretty much it. And they run them through a computer and an algorithm, and it pops out an answer. You're good to go or not. And I think where we begin to differentiate ourselves and what we do and what other lenders in our space do is we have to go back to first principles of credit and underwriting to make that determination. And then, to your point, you begin to negotiate. You find out, whether there's more detail, whether they have other properties. What's the income on those other properties? Are you making a profit on those? What's the market doing in terms of, the valuation of your property? That's a big issue today. What's the property worth?
What are some of the rules of thumb on leverage? So for a principal residence, if you're under 20% in terms of your deposits, you need insurance. They won't give you a mortgage if you've got nothing down. What are some of the rules of thumb on rental properties we should know?
So for all intents and purposes, rental properties do not qualify for the government programs or industry programs on insurance. So you're what we call a conventional mortgage, which means that we can lend up to 80% of the loan to value. But because of the risks associated with residential, at least in our case, we typically like to have that investor have more down on the property, more skin in the game, if you will. And we're typically looking at, a loan to what we call loan to value ratio of 65%, 60 to 65%. So we are asking investors to commit more of their capital in the property.
Interest rates are moving all the time, so I'm not going to ask you a specific question about rates, but I want to ask what premium a borrower would pay for this type of investment versus a principal resident. Is it 100 basis points? Is it 500 basis points?
I would say it's typically on the order of somewhere between 1.5 to 2%. Not more than that for a similar, for a borrower with a good quality credit profile. Again, it's not cookie cutter. And so the organizations, the banks like ourselves that do that, we have to do more work, and we have to ask, the value that we're creating and the enablement to actually do the mortgage is something that comes at a slight premium. But typically, if you remain a good quality credit and you're a solid investor, you're not what we would call subprime. You're not at much at significantly higher rate, but there are premiums associated with that.
Some of your clients pay in advance. How does that work, and why would you request or require that they do that?
So that's a feature that's, I think, fairly common in the United States. It's more innovative here. We began to employ it when we were starting to market ourselves to investors that were new to Canada. And it was a way, particularly investors who, again, you don't have a T4, so you don't have the source of income. These are typically higher net worth individuals. And so they have the assets available, the liquid assets available, and we're asking to reduce the risk that they deposit those assets in a secure account at our bank. And that's used by us in the event that you don't make your monthly payments, and gives us an opportunity to, you know, resolve on the property should there be problems in the future. And that reduction in our risk exposure enables us to offer a very competitive and lower rate than they would get otherwise somewhere else.
Spend any time on social media or on the internet, and you will see a lot of influencers who have drunk the Kool-Aid here on the power and magic of investing in rental properties. You know, why pay someone else's mortgage? This is the way to wealth, all that. And certainly for many humans, that is true. For some humans, it is not true. What are the pitfalls, or what are the holes in this narrative that rental properties are the easy way to make a buck?
Naivete. listening to the influencers, I think our experience with the borrowers that we have is, you know, typically this is not their first foray into the market. They have, you know, two or three properties, perhaps. They've demonstrated knowledge in the industry. And I think that's where it comes down to. If you're going to enter this market, you better do some homework first. It's listening to, you know, people like yourselves, real estate agents that you may know, talking to mortgage brokers. Do some homework before you dive into this market and just take it for what it is.
One last question. We have no idea where real estate prices will go over the course of a week or 5 years. What perspective would you provide in terms of the conservatism that investors should have now that this naivete about real estate always rising and twill ever be thus? There's a crack in that. Of course, there's a crack in that because of rising interest rates and affordability and all that. What perspective would you have on the sort of 5-year time horizon for the rental market, the rental property market?
Boy, that really is a hard question to answer because we've seen in this market, you know, housing prices falling and rental rates increasing because of supply and demand.
Yeah.
I think until the demand issues are solved in this country, which have been disrupted around the creation of adequate volume of housing, there's a real potential that rental rates will be, you know, seemingly counter-cyclical. Mm. That's a bit of a guess, and it's based on, you know, the disruptions that we're all seeing in the market. So notwithstanding rising rates, it would seem rental rates are going up, whereas others would have said they would have done something different. So I'm like you. I can't predict what's going to happen 5 minutes from that alone.
Yeah. Paul, thank you for your time today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for this conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Excellent. Paul Leonard, the CEO of Wealth One Bank of Canada. And he was here to talk about the financing of rental properties. It is a similar but very, very different game than financing your principal residence. That is our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsors. They are Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. You can send us your comments, your questions, your feedback, constructive or not, your story ideas, whatever. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. On social media, I am at Bruce Sellery on Twitter. That's SELLERY, or Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.